This is what the Red Book looks like. Jung said, if we possess the image, then we possess half the thing itself. And that idea of grasping the essence of what a thing can be is really also the essence of what Tibetan Buddhism does through the paintings upstairs, through the tankas. Carl Jung had a white Tara hanging in his studio tower at Bollingen on Lake Zurich. He was really the first person to introduce the concept of the Tibetan Book of the Dead to Europe, as well as the idea of the mandala. And, of course, what we have on the fifth floor gallery is an exhibition, Mandala, The Perfect Circle, curated by Martin Brown. And Martin Brown was also instrumental in securing the Red Book for the Rubin Museum of Art. So to him, we owe great thanks. He's our chief curator. He's not here right now, but I'm sure he'd love it if you sent him an email to say how great he is. Well, what we're doing is we've got this extraordinary opportunity to actually analyze the father of modern psychology himself, Carl Gustav Jung. How are we going to do this? Well, we're going to invite an analyst on stage, and that analyst will present to the guest on stage a folio, one of these richly hand-painted illustrations, folios in the Red Book itself, done by Carl Gustav Jung. She'll give it to our guest tonight and invite him to associate on the basis of whatever he sees in front of him. And we hope that conversation then to blossom from there. So this conversation could go anywhere. And that's sort of the idea. So who have we on stage tonight? We have Jane Selinsky. She is a Jungian analyst, a certified teacher and trainer of mandala assessment. Notice, mandala assessments through the Association of Teachers of Mandala Assessment and a board-certified music therapist. She is very well equipped for this evening. She's on the faculty of the C.G. Jung Foundation for Analytical Psychology, the C.G. Jung Institute of New York, and the Institute of Expressive Analysis. Multiply well equipped. And I'm going to present her with this secret folio drawn from the Red Book, which you'll present to our guest this evening. And this museum would not exist, or certainly not be as successful as it has been to date, if it were not for Professor Bob Thurman. His scholarship, his enthusiasm, his activism in all things Tibetan has popularized and made us acutely aware of this extraordinary culture. And indeed, he and Marilyn Rhee collaborated on the very first catalog of the Rubin Collection, which is available, soft cover, $20, upstairs at the shop. He's the Jaitsong Kapa Professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies in the Department of Religion at Columbia University, and he was proclaimed one of the 25 most influential people in America. And that is largely due to his long-lasting and hard friendship with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He has much to say about Tibetan culture, and we're probably going to see a little bit tonight what the link is between things Tibetan and things Jungian. So please welcome Professor Bob Thurman and Jane Selinsky.
Nice to see everyone. Yes. Nice to meet you, Jane.
Yes.
And may I call you Jane?
Yes, absolutely. And I can call you Bob.
Yes, please. Yes.
As Tim has just announced to both of us and to all of you, this is a very momentous experience tonight because what we're doing for the first time is actually exposing the general public to one of the folios that Jung has presented in his huge book that you have had a glimpse of in front of the stage. And this particular book has been in the making for many years. And the editor of this book has spent many, many, many hours doing research with this text. And it has come to New York in a very special time, in a very special way. And that comes to the Reuben. And I think that the beginning of this dialogue tonight really does bring in that initiation, so to speak, from a building and from a legacy in this particular museum that mm-hmm. has bridged both the East and the West and is open to exploring what Jung has brought to us at this point in time mm-hmm. and his struggles. And what we'll see tonight in the book is a little glimpse of the struggles that he did experience. The history of the book was that when he was actually going through a confrontation with his unconscious, that he started to do his own personal journaling, his own personal drawings, his sketches in what we call the black books. And the black books, if some of you have not seen it already, are downstairs on display. And in the display, you'll see his rough sketches of how he actually began to do the work. And after many years of working with it and reflecting on it, actually came to many times back and perfected this particular text that we actually have. So the actual folios as they are right now are in their better form, not the actual sketches that were begun in the black book. So tonight our task is to actually engage with one another, and I give you tremendous credit for actually being here and actually seeing this for the first time. I don't know whether I'd want to be in that seat.
It's okay.
So he will see this for the first time, and we will begin a dialogue. What we'll be doing, one of the words that were so significant for Jung happened to be the word of circumambulation. And that certainly goes along with what we're talking about tonight in terms of the mandala. The circumambulation to the center, the circumambulation to the self. And what we will be doing is looking at one of his mandalas and having what we call a circumambulation around it, an association mm-hmm. to it. So what Bob will be actually doing, we'll be taking a look at it, and we'll be able to see it on the screen. And we will be having a dialogue, and at the end of the dialogue, we will open it up to the audience. But what I'd ask you all to do, because Jung was so connected to the collective unconscious, that in essence, everyone in this room will be connected this evening. Mm. And as you're watching it, I'd ask you all to pay attention to what really is going on within each of you as you watch, as you see, and as you hear, so that we enter into it later, we will have a full collection of everyone that's in the room mm. along with the both of us. Okay?
Okay.
So I give you this first view of the folio.
Thank you. What do we have here? Oh, my.
And with any looking at something brand new, there takes time to reflect on it, time to actually enter into it. And I think that Bob will probably want to reverence that himself for a second or two or more, as much time as he needs to enter into it.
1928. It's quite amazing. It's like a city.
Mm.
And it's a fortified city. Mm. It has a moat.
You see that right away.
Mm-hmm. And it has like four entrances. Mm. And in the now in Tibetan tradition, I'm not sure if Jung was aware of that. In this, but he probably he was that in this sort of thing, the down direction is east.
Mm-hmm.
So the entry direction is from the east, usually, of mandalas.
Yes.
In the Tibetan, and I think he was probably aware of that.
Yes.
So in a way, the entry is coming up mm. into the mandala.
Can I just add one thing here as you continue to look into this? One of the interesting things about this, which really freed Jung from a period of his confrontation with his unconscious, when he really was working with the art and drawing and reflecting and writing, and mm-hmm. trying to integrate his personal experience, that it was when he received a text from Richard Wilhelm of the text that helped integrate for him what actually was going on with this the text was about the golden flower. And what Jung actually realized was that this particular work freed him from his fears that what he was doing all those years could have just been his own work and his own internal work. So instead, he finds out that there is this bridge between the East and between the West that really made him come to life, so to speak, and feel better about himself in terms of what he actually had been doing, and knew at that point in time that there was something further that he could begin to speak about this work, begin to share it with others. So this was a tremendous freedom for him at this point. And this was early in, I think, around 1928, as you referenced here.
Yeah, 1928. Well, it's very, it is very interesting, these two, the two crosses that he has that have this blue and red pattern on them. One is right in the front here in the East, and then one is up here in the, in the I guess it, the east west would be the northwest, which is sort of like one conclusion. Then there's a small little one over on this side, so there's a certain asymmetry. It's otherwise fairly symmetrical, and there's a lot of mazes here that go on, but these are all buildings. All of these are like buildings.
Right, they are.
All of these patterns are buildings. And some of them are closed, and some of them are open to the courtyard.
Right.
So it's very, very secure. And then, again, there's a second set of four entrances into the inner round city. And then in the center of that, an eight-segmented circle with something in the center where he discovered himself, again, with the cross pattern. His father was a minister, I think, right?
Yes, he was,
Christian
actually.
Minister.
Yes. And... he was a Christian minister, but it was a very difficult connection for him.
Well, of course.
Right.
Of course.
Very good.
And the thing is that, I think he, Jung always maintained for his exploration, and in the context of exploring the secret of the golden flower, which is this very elaborate Taoist visualization practice, extremely, extremely complicated and elaborate and very vivid, actually. And he also mentions that in his introduction to the Book of the Dead, which I haven't read in a long time. I confess I was told not to prepare anything at all by Mr. McHenry, who is the director. And so I didn't go back and reread things and do things like that.
It's probably best that you
just
see it for the first time.
But he had this idea that which was very normal in his time, that there is a Western personality and an Eastern one, and that although in his memories, dreams, and reflections, I remember very vividly his dream where he realizes he probably was previous existence in India. He had some connection from India. He felt that, you know, there's sort of, there has to be this kind of Western way of appropriating these things. You know, you can't go native. He was thinking in those days.
Right.
And this, of course, is something that I have struggled with in the Western Academy.
Can you say more
about
that?
Very much over the last 40 years, overcoming that, actually.
Can you say more about that on a personal level?
Well, because they were so shocked, you know. Because I was so shocked when I came back from living with Tibetans. For me, going to meet the Tibetans and going to India was like going home. Like not just a dream, but actually going home.
Right.
Having grown up in New York, I always felt I was living in a slightly loony city. And actually, in a way, lately, the way I describe that looniness is the alphabet, the English alphabet, which is a complete cuckoo. You know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. Luckily, we can memorize it, but it has no rhyme or reason. You know, the consonants, the gutturals, the vowels, they're all mixed up, and then you pronounce them in a way that they don't pronounce when you... I mean, it's just simply like that. And Sanskrit and Tibetan is logical. Very, very logical, and it's like the language, they call it, Sanskrit is called Devanagari, the alphabet is called Devanagari, which means the city of the gods.
So
and
for
it's very,
you,
very, so it's like a homecoming. So anyway, I shouldn't digress. So then coming back here, to hear from Western people that Asian people didn't have any sense of individuality, that Asian people, I mean, just a bunch of completely cuckoo ideas, that in the 1970s, when I began being a professor, were current in places like Harvard and Amherst and Yale and academic meetings, and people would sagely go on and on about how only we in the West have individuality, and they don't really even know they're there, those Asian people. I mean, it's so ridiculous, I can't express it. Jung was a pioneer.
Can I ask you one question? Can I ask you about how that affected you and your work as you began with that divergence?
Well, it sort of... it made me realize why I took rebirth myself in this in this like waspy lineage that I did, and to deal with these people who are actually, in a way, they're like at the periphery of Eurasia, and then they came over and genocided the native people here, then enslaved the black people, and then they're doing a bunch of other really naughty things still, and yet they think they're the absolute flower of civilization, which they aren't, you know. And
so it became a mission?
What?
It became a mission for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I slowly realized that it was, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. And at first, I must say, I was very, impatient with previous generations having not really collided head-on with it. I have a thing in my astrology, although I don't pay too much attention to that, but I think I was shocked that it's quite accurate. It's something about my personality. I enjoy something that's impossible. In fact, I have to be careful that I'm not doing it just because it's impossible.
Well, can we analyze that little laugh?
That's August 3rd is that day. And Obama, luckily, is August 4th, and he doesn't have the same problem. He has a different one. But anyway, for example, when I read his thing on the Book of the Dead, Carl Jung's thing, I liked it very much, and it drew my interest in that direction very, very much. Although I thought even then, before I knew anything, I thought he was a little over-cautious and over-worried about it.
Can you say more about what you meant?
Well,
about
this
being
thing about the Western personality, the Eastern personality. I mean, what is the Western personality? Here he's sitting, 1928, in Switzerland, luckily for him, and nearby where one of my great heroes and mentors of that time, of my early time, Hermann Hesse, who was down in Lugano, in the Ticino, which is a little more lush than Zurich. But anyway, he was in correspondence with Jung, and he wanted him to be analyzed by Jung, but they didn't quite, they had that kind of correspondence. And Hesse was German and had gone there to get away from the wars, which he didn't approve of, although he tried to help the wounded and so on. He was, he was patriotic, but he was against all the wars very much. So Carl himself is sitting here in a peaceful place, neutral place, between the two wars, and he's got himself into this tremendous fortification that he's got in here. This is like a garrison. All of these different places, you can see that they look. It reminds me. I was recently in Pompadour in France, and these buildings from above look like the stables where they had all the French cavalry or horses and so on. They look a little bit like that from the top, and then he's protected by this outer layer and these moats and fortifications. And then again he crosses through another mode into the inner layer and the circular thing, and then he can relax in here and he can enjoy the golden flower in safety.
Right.
On top of a cross so that Dad won't be too upset. I think. And then, but the point is, at least he's able, and then the third mode is in there, so there's actually three modes. And then he's in there, and then there's a green roof. The middle building is like a green, more fertile. It's still a white wall, but it has a green roof, the central building. It has this eight-segmented roof, which covers maybe inside there could be an eight-petaled golden flower in which the master is sitting, contemplating and looking outwards through all of these different doorways. It's really quite something. This thing. But you know what? I also, in Tibet, we have a tradition, or in the East we have a tradition, and I think you do it in the West. I think people do this with the Bible, where you open a book and then the first word you read is something interesting.
Significant.
So since I wasn't really allowed to prepare by studying the red book, I did open it. I sneaked over here when Tim wasn't looking. And I opened it, and what I saw in there was quite marvelous, and it said something about, how can I find my heart, it said. And then when you want to find your heart, you should... unfortunately, Tim closed it. I don't want to waste time leafing through it. But it says you should live the life you should live and not let others do things that you think you should do. You should live your life to the full, and then you will discover your own heart. Right. And that's very auspicious, I think.
Right. And in a sense, that connects with, really, this picture, the connection to the East and the West. And I think, in a sense, your connection to this...
Yes, I think
your
the connection here is that he wants to find his heart, of course. I mean, he wrote those words, too. And he wants to find his heart, his heads. But he feels... I think he's a little bit threatened by his culture that he's in. Probably because he was, in a previous life, as he said in the Memories and Dreams, he had lived in the Indian culture, which is really, I believe personally from my study of history and 40 years of teaching and so on, although I don't claim to Toynbee-esque-like knowledge of history, although I read Toynbee. But I think India was really the central, most evolved place in Eurasia, actually. More so than China, certainly, and certainly more than West Asia or Europe, which were peripheral. Because India was much more wealthy, and the women were much more powerful before they were conquered by the Muslims and then the Christians. And the Brahmins didn't really have charge over them like they think they do now, when they think they always did. They did not in those days. And so India was more tolerant. You could bring out your imagination in India. You could be more relaxed, actually. Even the kings were tolerant of nonconformists. People were much more individualistic in India in ancient time, even still today, actually, than in the industrialized world. And India still really will step, I believe, in this century into its rightful place as a leader of the world. And I have no passport. I am not paid by India. I have nothing to do with them. They luckily give me visas to go there, and they have sheltered His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which is lucky for them, in a way, as well as lucky for the Tibetans. And I always loved that country and the Sanskrit language. And it's just something amazing and marvelous. And so he probably came from there, and then he's in this much more, to use a term from his own colleague and fellow student, Wilhelm Reich, he's in a culture where he feels he needs more armor because of the roughness, actually, really, of European culture as it's coming into its, you know, this time is the period when Europe has been dominating the entire planet and genociding everybody here and there and sucking all its wealth into Europe, and therefore creating the delusion that Europeans subsequently think that they somehow are the richest people in the world. Meanwhile, they're just the big pirates, as Buckminster Fuller called them, they're the great pirates. You know? And they took the wealth from everywhere, and they're very rough with each other. You know, they have a constant warfare kind of idea they have in their history. 100 years war, 30, I mean, every kind of war. Caesar, even Achilles. His father's name, I saw, was Achilles. In a little tiny research I did in the last few minutes. And, you know, Achilles is like Rambo. You know? And he'd been worshipped in Europe, just like Sylvester Stallone in ancient Greece. Smelly, you know, sulky, brittle, weird guy. And he's been sort of worshipped because he presents himself in Greek pentameter. But my point is that so he needs to retreat, to find his heart, he needs to retreat into this extremely impregnable mandala. Mm-hmm. And then he can begin to relax in the middle of that and begin to let his heart open and begin to, like, because he feels that the armor is out there, so he doesn't have to armor himself. And he can begin to work on himself.
Do you see?
And it's very interesting. What is a very interesting clue here to me about him is this especially beautiful and elaborate cross, you know, which is, there's three of them, actually, in the three obvious ones, two of which are different sizes in this beautiful red and blue with little patterns inside. And then there's the one very plain one that's the roof of a building over here, one more. And these seem to be his two, I think, where he's more happy with. This one is a little, he's worried about that one over there. And so he's got them in some place, and he's paying tribute to them in a certain way and making them beautiful.
Can I ask you, before you go further, do you see any connection to this particular mandala that he has done?
Yes.
And a Tibetan mandala?
A Tibetan mandala? Mm-hmm. Well, yes, although it's not... it has such differences with the Tibetan mandala. This one, because of the fact that the gates are at the sort of south and north, although, as I say, I'm not sure he's east and west. And I'm not sure for him the bottom may be south, which is the way you normally in the west you make a map, you know, and your east is to the right. But in Tibetan mandala, the east is the bottom. But whichever it is, the fact that those are the only two entrances, there's no entrances on two sides. And the four, there are four gates, which is similar, but these gates are also aimed in a certain way. So this mandala is like, although it has a fortress element, it also has movement in the direction. And its sides are kind of impenetrable, the two sides, you know. And if you come in the bottom, which is the way you would most normally, if it's in the Tibetan one, you sort of come and you're off center there because it is a defensive structure. The Tibetan mandala is a structure with four gates, so it's meant to be easily accessible from the different directions. And you know, rather like the center one here, he has the center one, which is round, and then has these checkered kind of pattern, and then the four gates, and the four gates lead directly into the four entrances of the house. That's why this is the more relaxed one. This is where he's being more eastern, actually. You see, and note that to get onto that island, you come in the quarter directions again, in the same sort of movement of going up or down, depending on how he's thinking of the direction, which I don't know. He's once he's secured here, then he has an open to four directions mandala in the middle, which would be more like a Tibetan type of mandala. And
now, in the center, you mentioned that there was the difference in the color. There's the dark color and there's the lighter color. It's a little bit difficult to determine here, but there is the difference between the black and the white on that floor with the squares and the centers?
Well, the black and white, black and yellow, the walls of the building are white, and all of the outer buildings seem to, well, they're a little whitish and beige, they are. But the walls are white, but the roof is what I had noticed. The roof is green. And then there are these little green lawns, look like little green lawns around.
Let me just clarify. Petals. You're talking about the center.
Yeah, the roof. Very central building, the roof is the only green roof in the whole structure.
Okay.
You know,
right.
which is nice and auspicious, actually.
Okay. And actually, that is supposed to be more of a goldish tint.
That green is supposed to be gold?
Yeah.
Really, on the roof?
I know, it doesn't look
well. Well, there's
right.
a little shading, yes. Yeah. And there is the yellow and black pattern. And the yellow might be gold and black pattern, you could say. Yes.
So one of the things that he was trying...
And then he has these lawns, 16, which are like 16 petal lawns. 16 petals are associated with the throat chakra, and which is usually has 16 petals, and in the subtle nervous system, which he may know, actually. And I think that the golden flower may also resonate with that from India. And so he has them as little lawns. They don't have a petal shape, but they're like a petal. And they have also small little U-shaped buildings guarding them, a little still guarding going on there. But it's more relaxed in there, you know? Mm-hmm. Like if he was going to sing a song on the roof, then people could sit on the lawn and listen. And they could listen. And it's all kind of safe in there. And so he's happy in there, I think.
So the center would be a very significant spot.
Oh,
in this
I think
particular
so.
Drawing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's also open, and he's receiving from all directions in the center. Once the sort of the negatives cannot penetrate the outer perimeter and the outer city. On the other hand, of course, to see it in a more positive way, once having gotten in there and developed a very positive vision himself, he can go back out, and then these people in the city will get the benefit of that blessing that he develops.
I mean, one of the
but
things.
But he does keep the crosses in the outer part.
Notice. One of the things that's notable in that center circle, where you have the dome in the center, and the blocks, so to speak.
Yes.
If we look at his theory of individuation, he talks about the shadow and integrating the shadow.
Yes.
And this can represent that integration between the opposites.
Yes,
I think so. The dark and the light.
Yeah, the checker pattern, I think, does do that.
The checker pattern does give you a sense that you're integrating the shadow and you're integrating the opposites, And once you can integrate the opposites, you can move into that safer spot and closer to that inner core,
yes.
that inner self.
Yeah. Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Now, in terms,
I think it's quite wonderful. Actually.
In terms of the color green,
yes.
okay, around the center, well, it's not quite the center, but one of the inner center circles, that green color.
Yes.
Right? Can you just do a little bit of an association to the green and what the green might represent?
Well, the green, I mean, he has these field patterns outside, and so this is set in a countryside which is cultivated. There are stripes in the fields, and so you have a sense of farm cultivation and abundance of food. The green are fields that are planted, the brown are fields that are fallow. And so the idea is that it's well provisioned. This is a wealthy, this is in a wealthy setting because of the food being present there. And there's plenty of water also keeping these moats filled, although there's no obvious place where the water flows in. Mm-hmm. You don't see that. Mm-hmm. But there is plenty of water, and there's the inner moat is also full.
Right, and if you look at the moats, you know,
yes.
you've got certainly three of them. Okay.
Yes.
That if we look at the moat as underlying all of this, you know, uh-huh. Jung also looks at that water moat as the unconscious, so that the unconscious is encompassing the totality mm-hmm. of this mandala.
Yes. Mm. Okay. Yes.
Now, the entrance, if we looked at this as a city,
uh-huh.
What might you think of this as a city and its reference
well,
to...
Well, what it reminded me of a little when I first saw it is the city of the Medicine Buddha, which is a particular mandala, unusual amongst Tibetan mandalas, in that the Medicine Buddha's palace is in the middle, mm-hmm. where he's giving his instruction to the Hindu gods, the Hindu rishis, the Buddhist gods and bodhisattvas, and the Buddhist monks, who are the ones who actually spread the medicine in India, the medical tradition in India. And but then outside the palace is a whole set of buildings, which is actually a city, mm-hmm. where all kinds of people are living who presumably are working, are themselves beneficiaries of the healing energy coming from within, and also are sort of live there, but then the idea is they go further out. And then around that, in the countryside of that mandala, there are, in the different directions, there are medicinal plants. Mm-hmm. And that one actually, unusually, it has south in the bottom, and the sun power is strong in the south, and therefore hot plants, like mm-hmm. very spicy, that help mm-hmm. with cold diseases. Moon power is powerful in the north, and cooling plants mm-hmm. for fevers grow there. And then east and west have there's a panacea type of tree grows there called the Myrobalan tree, and in the west there are all kind of mineral waters and minerals mm-hmm. and things. So it's like a medicine vision that mm-hmm. everything is healing. Mm-hmm. And I must say that this reminded me of that
right.
When I first saw it. It's the first thing mm-hmm. I thought of. And the reason I did is because of seeing the little windows and doors in all of these buildings in the outer mm-hmm. structure, you realize that this is a city of people.
Right.
And so that's, you don't usually have, you have some deities in mandalas in mm-hmm. the Tibet, most Tibetan mountains. Mm-hmm. You don't have like a whole city mm-hmm. like that, except in that Medicine Buddha mandala.
Right, and the significance of the a number of those opening in.
That there are four?
Yeah.
Well, I think, yes, the significance there is that he wants it to resonate with the four east, west, south, north directionality of his central mm-hmm. mandala, where he is hiding out, or he is trying to find where his heart is. Mm-hmm. And he wants it to resonate with that, but because he's setting this in the European countryside, he doesn't feel quite safe having it fully open in all directions. Mm-hmm. He's not, you know, he might be assaulted in different directions. Mm-hmm. People, armies coming from all sides. So he has only two really directions that he allows, mm-hmm. but the four are really essentially four that really, in a more open culture where there was less barrier between the ordinary mm-hmm. world of violence and trouble and mm-hmm. government and militarism mm-hmm. and so forth. In a world where there was less barrier than that, it would be open in four directions equally. Mm-hmm. So he has taken those four and put them in a more controlled, only they can come this way and maybe they go out that way. And you definitely have the feeling here because of the way the perspective is. You see, this is like the entrance here. Mm-hmm. So you come in on these entrances, and then you it takes you some effort to get over. Then you hear again, you're still only coming in these same four directions. These entrances aren't the middle one, but then once you're in the middle, this one you go straight in. So I think that the four comes from the four directions, but he doesn't allow people to come from all of the directions.
And for him, the four was a very significant number of wholeness.
I'm sure. Yeah. It's a four directions. Right. And then, well, we have 10 directions in Buddhism. We call it 10 directions because you have the four quarter directions, and then you have the up and down. Mm-hmm. So they talk about the 10 directions Buddhas. They have this, so there's an axis of up and down as well. It's coming from below. And often in Tibetan mandalas, they have fierce deities guarding the zenith and the nadir, who protect against any untoward energies coming from those directions. It's really interesting.
Let me just say,
I can see him making this and feeling really more and more secure as he goes inward.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then, you know, whenever that subsequently having made it, when he sees it, I think he jumps straight into the center, and he's happy there, and because he knows that there's this whole community that is kind of keeping watch.
And it's built on that city form. And
yes.
In the center, he is in the center, having, you know, the opposites have been coagulated, and he's in the center of the self, you know, with the unconscious that has been underlying
yes.
all this. It's hard to tell with this, but, you know, this was said to have been done in jade. So if you could just say a little bit about what you would feel if you had seen this in jade.
In where?
In jade. The color of jade.
Jade?
The jade green color.
If I had seen this
the external,
carved in jade?
Yeah, saying? The external piece after the first moat was supposedly done in jade. Jade color. Yeah.
Well, of course, what jade is, in ancient time, jade was used to make axes, actually. Jade is very, very hard.
To make what? I didn't hear you.
What?
To make what? Jade was used to make
axes. Mm. So you had jade axe blades, and cutting
axes.
Tools were made of jade, in addition to ornaments, of course. But jade is extremely hard as a stone. It doesn't break and shatter easily. And so a jade, this whole thing, actually, if it was jade, although if it was more symmetrical and these parts would stick out, you would have a six-bladed shiken, what the ninjas call a shiken, you know, which is a whirling, like a small discus, you know, which is a weapon, actually. So the fact that it's jade, to me, increases the fortification aspect of it, actually, really. And I wonder if I don't remember the golden flower thing. If they do have an outer layer of jade, they might, because they treasure jade, of course, in China. They have very high-quality jade. And
This particular...
Yeah,
what I was going to say is that this is very significant because of the connection between the East and the West, as I started to say in the beginning, with him finding that the principles of the mandala had existed in the Eastern culture.
Sure.
And that was given to him by Wilhelm, and the recognition that he was in his tower in Bollingen actually doing this work. Mm-hmm. And so to actually see this in confirmation from another source actually gave him the freedom and the confirmation that he needed to continue the work and to recognize that this was what he was talking about in terms of mandala. He recognized that he could utilize this theory and that there was significance, and that was the connection between, you know, the East and the West, that we have within us
right.
the East and the
right,
opposite.
Right, right.
You know,
well,
so
another thing that this makes me think about him is that, of course, what a mandala really is a powerful and sacred place where you can unfold your sensibility and your understanding and your love and compassion, actually, for the world without fearing that you'll be hurt, that you'll become too vulnerable. So it has a kind of a royal palace element, and it has also a secure sanctuary element, a mandala. And it is not just a geometrical pattern. It is a kind of city or palace or a three-dimensional holographic space wherein you are the building. And the other thing about it, of course, is that in mandalas, So there's like a bunch of them upstairs here, Tibetan mm-hmm, ones, mm-hmm. in the lovely exhibit on the third floor, and or whatever floor, and the which is that you, although you meditate yourself as the central deity within it, you simultaneously are meditating yourself as the outer deities in it. So you are a you visualize yourself in it. People don't realize that. They think that they're just the one deity in there. Some of them only do have the one deity in it. But the others, most of them have several deities, like a retinue of deities. But that retinue is the central deity as well. So in a way, you're imagining yourself as a community. And you are seeing yourself from, you are seeing out of the eyes of all the members of the community. And so you are making yourself equal with all the other people.
Which is a connection. Which is a connection to that.
Excuse me?
Which is a connection to this one.
Yeah, which I think here, in the fact that he's made this as a city, I think he is, although you seem to be retreating into a center where you are separate and everybody else is guarding you, on the other hand, there is a return movement where you then embrace your oneness with everyone else. You see, as you like a snail, you know, paranoidly creeping away in there from World Wars I and II and all of the fierce neighbors around Switzerland, you are kind of opening up, and then you are seeing yourself in all of the other citizens of this city, and you're embracing them, you know. And somehow I think these two crosses maybe are his parents. I don't know why. I feel they are. And the one over here gets really short-changed. I wonder
which one.
You know, because he doesn't
have three. Which one do you think that might be?
Beautiful, elaborate crosses, colorful crosses. One gets a little shrunken, kind of a little dinky, little orange-roofed cross.
So, do you have a sense of which?
What?
Do you have a sense of which one that might be?
I don't know enough about his biography, but I think maybe it might be
most.
Maybe if he was conscious of it, if he writes about it, he probably doesn't. But I don't. I have no idea. But maybe they switch. Maybe he thinks it's one and actually it's the other.
So it's really the father.
He might be afraid to put the one that he really wants to put in the lesser one.
The lesser one would be the father.
I think that that's what it would be. But maybe he wants the father to feel the bigger one.
Maybe.
Because they're a bunch of chauvinists, even more so than we are, even then. Although we're bad enough, still.
As you look at this, you know, how does it make you feel?
How does it make me feel?
Yeah, what kind of feelings arise?
Well, it makes me feel good. I feel good. Makes me feel good.
Yes, and go on.
I feel happy. I feel happy for him, actually. I do feel happy for him. And, you know, I think of him as a pioneer, and I think he's probably around somewhere. When did he pass away? In the 60s, right? 67?
61.
Oh, so then he was reborn in the... But he was too young to enjoy the 60s, poor guy. He had to do that sort of second half-baked 60s that they tried to do in the 70s. That, of course, dates me. That would make him 47 years of age now, prime of life, somewhere. You know who you are, you know. He might even be here, you never know. Anyway, or maybe he went to Tibet or something. No, not to Tibet. He would know geopolitics better. But it makes me happy for him, I think. And I feel at home in this little city. You know what I mean? If I was traveling in Switzerland and I found such a city, I would be happy there. I think Obama would be happy in the central part there, hanging out with him. I think that Barack Obama would be happy there.
Now, if you were to write something about what you see tonight,
yes,
in relation to the city and the mandala in the city and the significance of the city in relation to the circle and in relation to architecture, what would you say?
What would I say if I wrote something?
If you wrote it, or
yes,
if you were going to write it.
Yes. Well, I think I would say that... I don't know what I would say. I would find out what I would say when I started writing it. But... I've reached that stage of like either spontaneity or senility. I'm not sure which. But I think what I might write is I might say that we still have a lot to learn, and that we can find, we can connect back to. We of course have total lot to learn from things that happened in higher places of civilization. I mean, the great lesson for us, I think, in the West, that Obama represents, which is why I think he's so intensely hated by those who are still stuck on the violent domination mode, what Rihanna Eisler called the dominator mode of people. I think they're so mad because he, first of all, he respects his wife, clearly. We could see that in Chicago when he was nominated. Mm-hmm. You know? He brought out and said, this is my rock, in contradiction to the other, his opponent, who barely knew his wife was on stage with him, the poor thing. You know? He didn't even thank her and all the people he thanked in his concession speech. And then he gave her like some kind of little peck like that as he was walking off. And she like looked like she was dodging. I wouldn't blame her. And whereas Obama brings out Michelle, you know, clump, you know, like my rock, he said, you know. So that is very comforting and frightens, of course, all the freaks who are don't want to, you know, ratify the ERA and all this, you know. And then second, he's mixed race. He's not black. I love that black comedian who says, I'm tired of hearing how he's black. He ain't black, he's white. He's just as white as he's black, and I'm tired of him going black. And that's true. You know? So he's this total mix, and then he's multicultural. He lived around the world. And then he realizes that America is part of the world and it doesn't like the dominating. And that's the way we have to cross that bridge now. We have to all learn that and deal with that. And especially India. We all need desperately India. This whole thing that's happening there is these people who can't stand that India exists, you know, and want to destroy India. Actually, they don't really want to destroy us as much as they want to destroy India, those people. That's their real enemy. That's why they don't like that we want them to have a strong civilian government and a nice civilian society, because they want to maintain their terrorists to attack India. Mm. And India is our real partner. We haven't known that for 50, 60 years. India is our great partner in the world. India is Carl Jung's source. India is the source of these mandalas. Mm. We have tremendous amount to learn. By seeing this, and seeing since people still, he still is pointing the way for so many people, Carl Jung, you know. And actually, his colleague, Wilhelm Reich, should be, but people are frightened of Wilhelm Reich, I think. Too scary for them, you know, all that orgasm. Ooh, that's too scary, you know. And getting rid of their emotional armoring. Ooh, terrible. It's a scary business. And it might be fun, but scary. So Carl Jung is safer, it's like spiritual, you know. But anyway, they will take some direction from him, and they will rediscover. They can come into this in this mandala. They can come into this home there in this mandala. Then they might realize that they have to learn what is the secret of the golden flower themselves.
Right. And one thing I think that's significant, which you just said, was the whole issue of safety.
Yes.
In essence, when one is going into the unconscious and going in deeper to the unconscious, that is not necessarily a safe thing. That there are the unconscious shadows that come up that need integration, and that only then is one able not to take up the spear.
Well, that's one true, but I would say this, though. I would say that from the Buddhist and in Eastern in general civilizational point of view, the things that seem to be unsafe in the unconscious are there whether you look for them or not.
Yes.
And actually, they're much more dangerous when you don't know what they are.
Absolutely.
You feel them gnawing at you. Mm-hmm. And they, like, give you indigestion and cancer and heart disease. Right. And they give you bad temper. And they spoil your life, actually.
Or you can
act out of
them.
And then, even worse, is they carry you on their shoulders into places where you really don't want to go after you die. And because of the awareness of this, in cultures where people were more peaceful and more allowed to really look into themselves and more allowed to really be themselves, because the cultures were not using people as ciphers of production and ciphers of violence, military and industrial production, like our society. So in those cultures, people got to look in there at the eros and thanatos in there, you know, and they got a good look at it, and they decided, wow, in this human lifetime that I have, when I have critical distance and I can look at myself critically and introspectively and alchemically and with focus. I better look at this, and I better bring them up, and I better see what is really me, and I better defang the different kinds of creatures that are in there,
right.
and then I can go. I can be secure that wherever I go, when I lose all control, which will be death, and I will not be able to. This nonsense, that false security that Western materialist people live in, that there'll just be nothing happen to them when they die, which is just completely, it's the worst kind of blind faith of all kind. If you have blind faith in the nothing awaiting you, then you are really having faith in that which nobody ever has discovered and never will, and which contradicts everything that anybody has ever experienced, which is all of nature has continuity. There's no discontinuity in nature ever observed by anybody. So if you have faith in nothing that awaits you as a secure and aesthetic place, you are cuckoo. Really. And you actually know it. And when you get down to where you're on those machines in the ICU or the hospice, wherever it is, and you're trying to forgive everybody and be forgiven by all the people you've been mean to all your life, then you know darn well you can't count on being nothing.
And I think,
so the point, my point only is that those things of the eros and thanatos, you know, the unconscious, although it might seem dangerous, it's much more dangerous not to explore it.
Right. And what I want to do is just really agree with you. Because, yes, it's dangerous.
Yes.
But at the same time, exactly what you said could be a Jungian text. Because if, in fact, it's not taken care of, that's when you do have the eruptions, that's when you do have war, that's when you do have... aggression and fights, and every bit of the internal unconscious then is seeping out in all different territories with no control.
Exactly.
So that it's a matter of trying to integrate it. It may be scary going into it, looking at it, observing it, but in fact, if one does not do that, the dangers are far greater.
That's right. That's good. But I'm just saying in the culture that is more civilized, because of people being aware of their responsibility to their continuity in for themselves and for others, and being aware that there's no way of escaping the consequences of the way they are, their being, then that those dangers can put one in much longer suffering than just what might erupt in this one lifetime.
Correct.
If you follow me.
Yes.
And that's why in those cultures, people really, just like in old-fashioned theistic cultures, where they simplify it, and it's like eternal heaven or eternal hell sort of thing, which doesn't actually make that much sense, so people, it doesn't scare people in a way enough. But if it's an evolutionary thing where your negative, your the inner hells of your unconscious, if you haven't explored, they can make you hells in the future. That's much more sobering, and therefore, those cultures... insist, the individuals in those cultures over many, many centuries insisted that their kings and their priests and their powerful people allow the individuals the space, the social space, the institutions, the education, that to really look into themselves. And they had huge monastic traditions in Buddhism and Taoism and eventually Hinduism, which resisted them at first, and Jainism, in those cultures, which is expensive to support, people on permanent scholarship all over the place. You know? But they allowed, there was much more of that. It was always a big fight in the West for some Christians to get a little bit of bread, you know, had to make some champagne and jam and give it back. And then with Protestantism, they confiscated the whole thing right away. You know? So because of the stinginess of the people in the West, and because of their coming out of a poorer environment. So anyway, it makes me happy. I'm happy to be here with you. I like also this museum. I like this museum. By the way, this museum, Don Rubens Museum, wonderful institution, originally, before it crystallized into being called the RMA, the Rubens Museum, it had a name, a working name, which was called the Museum of the Mythic Image, which instead of MoMA was MOMMY. I always liked that. I thought it was great. So in a way, that's a subtext here, you know. RMA is the Irma, almost like Uma, but no, Irma, but it's semi-vowel, but it was mommy, and that's Don's heart is like that. Don is a Jungian heir, and he was deeply, why he loved Tibetan art so much, to collect all of this Tibetan art, is he felt that the Tibetans were the ones who were the best disciples of Jung, you could say, or maybe teachers of Jung, in the sense that they really had developed a culture around the idea of the highest aim of a human life is to explore themselves and to integrate themselves and to bring out the shadow and embrace it and then ride it, actually, without it being harmful any longer, you know. And to unify light and shadow and dark and bright and so forth, male and female, within themselves. And so that is why he collected this. That's why he's drawn to it, you know, himself. You know?
And I think that one can see in this building...
Excuse me?
One can feel in this building and see that integration.
That's right.
Just in the walls. You
That's
can
right.
walk and feel through
yeah, as you,
each of the
as
rooms.
You go up the staircase, it gets more and more and more integrated.
Right.
And then as you come down, you disintegrate.
Right. And if you look up, you can hopefully... achieve the top.
That's right.
Right, right.
That's right. So it's so auspicious to encounter this here and to encounter Jung. We'll have to go back and study more about him. And it's marvelous. I can't understand why it took so long for this to become available and become people become aware. Oh yes, he said Richard Wilhelm in Frankfurt. He said so he met with Richard Wilhelm in Frankfurt. And there's something.
This old
writing is hard to read.
Yeah, he actually had done this work for many years, but the family would not release it.
Uh-huh.
It was only through many negotiations and a few people here in New York City that were connected and made connections with the Rubin that it actually was able to have a birth here.
Tim McHenry told them that if they didn't release it, they would be sending Don over there. They released it. Don gets something when Don wants it.
Well, we were lucky enough to get it, and we were lucky enough to have you. So
yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Find the passage.
It's page 163.
What?
163.
You are so great. I was kicking myself when he closed it that I didn't note the page.
And actually, while he's flipping through, the book is sectioned in two areas. At the beginning, actually, it's the folio. It's
in 263.
No, it's back here, in the front here.
This was written in English,
Okay. That the text itself has two parts to it. And the first part is done in the calligraphy, and it's done with the drawings that Jung himself had done. And then on the back end of the book are the translations that have been done by the editor, Sonu. So when one is reading it, one is flipping back and forth to get an idea of what is actually being expressed. I think it's a good idea, the way they have put it together myself, in terms of being able to experience the totality of it and then go back and read. But I know that he has said it might be easier for you to read about it first and then go experience the drawings later. But for myself, it was much easier and I had a better feel when I was doing it the opposite direction, where looked at the drawings, got a feel for them, and then went later to the actual text.
Thank you. What do we do now?
We're going to ask questions, but I was wondering if you were able to find them.
Can do questions, and I'm just trying to find this thing that I first opened.
All right, good. Do we have any questions? Yes. And I'm going to be repeating the question, so if you would do me a favor and just try to speak it as loud as you can, and then I'll repeat it so everyone can hear.
I think it's important to know that.
That's good.
It's important to note that when Wilhelm brought the book, that Jung saw in the book, The Secret of the Golden Flower, the mandalas that he saw, some of his patients were spontaneously drawing those mandalas.
Right, and
that's what originally grabbed his attention.
Right.
They were spontaneously coming out of the patients themselves.
Yes. What? Go ahead. No, I was going to repeat that, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. And the other thing I wanted to comment on was the shadow contents coming out. Mm-hmm. This concept of just letting the thoughts come and meditating with them. Sometimes it can be dangerous to do that.
Yes.
And you need a trained therapist to be there, it isn't always the only solution.
Right.
Many times it depends on the individual person.
Okay. So let me just repeat a little bit of what you said. The significance of Jung finding that particular text, right? Because what he was recognizing that his patients were in the Eastern work. Okay. In actuality, they were Jung himself. You'll see these here, the samples that he talked about as being his patients. But that was the most significant part about it. When he received that text, he realized, my God, this is coming alive in another culture. It now gives credence to something that has just come up spontaneously to him in a type of crisis that he was going through with this confrontation with the unconscious. And so it gave him more credence to believe that it wasn't just a crisis, it was something that was more universal. And connecting with that text made that come together. And your point about just delving into the unconscious, absolutely, that's not something that one does lightly. That one needs to have someone to do that with, and or needs to have years of experience to be able to do that alone and freely able to, you know, do that kind of work. So that's, yes, I appreciate
that. I would like to say to that too that, of course, working with mandalas and using the imagination in the sort of yoga of imagination, that is the creative meditation of tantra and mandala, that requires initiation and it requires a mentor. And it is not like sort of critical philosophical practice or basic monastic practice. It's a deep thing. You know? And prior to that, there is a whole process of deconstructing routinized imagination and so on that then enables, makes one qualified to receive such initiation. So it is dangerous. It's like now people, I want to go on a weekend and do lucid dreaming. People are into, but that is also dangerous when you get into your subtle realm of dreaming and things without some direction, some help. It can lead to some funny things. I quite agree with that.
And one of the things...
I found my page, by the way.
Good. Hold on to it. One of the things that was also significant and important for Jung was the whole idea of projection. And so when, at this point in time in the Western culture, when in a therapeutic situation people are drawing the mandalas, uh-huh. One can receive that projection on the paper and have more to talk about, similar to what you actually were doing. Mm-hmm. Only you would be doing the drawing, and then we would be projecting onto the paper and then discussing some of the material that would be coming out of it. And I would say, just a little snippet, in terms of the kinds of things that seemed important to you, obviously your whole historical background came through, and the fire and the intensity with which you have in terms of your work and how it connects to who you are came through very loud and clear.
I see.
So that happens when one draws, one projects onto, and then there's the dialogue between the paper and the person and the mentor or the therapist, et cetera, et cetera. Yes?
I wonder if you could elaborate just slightly about India being our partner and those who are against it. Who are they and how are they?
Well, what people don't know here, Osama bin Laden is a big hero in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Right now, the Kerry bill gave $7.5 billion to build civilian society and civil government in Pakistan, and the military is having a bird about it. And they kicked out the ambassador here in Washington, and they don't want that. Because the Pakistani military has controlled that country for 50, 60 years, and we've been in alliance with them against India and Russia, because India insisted on being neutral during the Cold War, because they wanted to make peace and mediate. So we've always had a weird idea about India, our country. And what we don't know is he's popular there because he has promised the Pakistanis that he will lead them in the reconquest of India and there will be a new Mughal Empire. And that's their real goal. The Taliban, those Lashkari, all of those like terrorists who attacked, the Indian parliament. It was the equivalent of attacking the Congress building here in Washington. Can you imagine if that happened to us? You know, the 9/11 freaked us out, but they continuously attack India all the time. And they don't want, that's why they won't let us win the Afghan war. They are the ones who, we're having a war against the Pakistan military, really. Mm. That's what it is. And then the foolish Bush and people funded them hugely. And they want more funds, and then they'll pretend to spend it to chase our Taliban. But actually, they're building forces against us. And India is the big democracy with us, and they're into nonviolence. Barack Obama says he admires Gandhi above all people. There's something, the American-Indian connection, you know, that it could develop would be extremely powerful in this world. And nobody knows this, but in the American Revolution time, it was certain Indian princes who were Francophiles, actually, and France, who helped us against Britain to get free, you know, and the Indians tried to help us, and the British, and the Indians even saved our revolution, because there was a moment where they were going to reinforce the British forces here, which could have crushed Washington and company, but then there was a vote in the British Parliament that those troops should rather be sent to India to consolidate their hold on India, because India was more valuable than the United States, the 13 colonies in the United States. They said to them, do you want timber and fur and tobacco, or do you want jewels and silks and tea and spices? Which do you want? In the British Parliament. And so then they didn't reinforce here, and we got free. So anyway, it's a whole story. It's a kind of mystical thing about India. Anyway, can I share in between questions this one thing? Just as an omen for the opening of this event. I mean, there's a long-term event that Tim is orchestrating here with everyone, and being, you know, looking at different images and seeing what they think. And because when I opened it, just to see what it would say to me first, and I picked the section, the English translation, which he wrote in German in his hand, called Soul and God, which was not the one with this image. I don't know what the image it was. But it just says this, the first words I read. But how can I attain, this is Jung speaking in translation, but how can I attain the knowledge of the heart? You can attain this knowledge only by living your life to the full. You live your life fully if you also live what you have never yet lived, but have left for others to live or to think. You will say, but I cannot live or think everything that others live or think, end quote. But you should say, the life that I could still live, I should live, and the thoughts that I could still think, I should think. It appears as though you want to flee from yourself so as not to have to live what remains unlived until now. But you cannot flee from yourself. It is with you all the time and demands fulfillment. If you pretend to be blind and dumb to this demand, you feign being blind and deaf to yourself. This way you will never reach the knowledge of the heart. The knowledge of your heart is how your heart is. From a cunning heart you will know cunning. From a good heart, you will know goodness. Mm. Yeah. Thank you, Carl. Look, come back. Mm. Come. Please, question. Mm. Yes, lovely. Mm. That's just wonderful.
And, you know, in conjunction with what you're just saying,
yes,
the whole connection with the heart goes back to the center of this particular folio. And along with that, the whole process that Jung devised, which was the individuation process, which was the connection between the conscious and the unconscious, and bringing up the unconscious so that one could integrate it, so that one could be in that center. And when one was in the center, then one could be better connected to the heart, and then there would be the connection with the heart and the outward movement and the back and the forth.
You know what it makes me think of when I look at it like this, up there? Mm. And I wonder if that isn't part of it, actually, because of the China thing. It looks like a turtle.
Right.
And I hadn't noticed that sitting, holding it here. Mm-hmm. But it looks like a turtle. And there's a wonderful thing in a Buddhist myth about the Bodhisattva Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, that he went and he took rebirth in China always to help the Chinese, because he felt sorry for them because Buddha went to India. And the Chinese did not get to receive Buddha because they were more backward than the Indians, like the Europeans were at the time of Buddha. And so he went there, and then he wanted to show them the process of divination, you know, which before the I Ching this was, which they used to do with the turtle shell, you know. Mm-hmm. But apparently in the very ancient time, Manjushri emanated himself as a golden turtle. Mm. And then he slew himself, and then the patterns on his back, which in a way those buildings do look like patterns on a turtle's back, which I didn't see holding it closer. But the patterns on his back, then they, you know, they can tell, they can read like runes. And of course, then they would heat the turtle shell and look on the inside. They would, of course, kill the turtle, the Chinese divinators. And then they would see patterns of cracks on the inside of the turtle shell. And it is said that a lot of the Chinese characters were derived from the patterns of cracks in the turtle shell. So it's a very primordial thing in the Chinese culture. And it does look like a turtle.
Well, it definitely looks like a turtle, and then even the inner circle.
And that explains the four things going in the direction. You see the four paws of the turtle.
Right.
And then the... But the head of the turtle is retracted. You know, because he's like... Head and chin is peeking into the golden flower.
But if you think about the dimension of it, also, if you think about the turtle's back, it would be in the center, in the center, which would be...
That's right. That's right. Mm. Turtle is a wonderful creature.
Yes.
You mentioned two things. One about the difference or you mentioned two things. One about the integration or difference between the East and the West, and also conjectured, or maybe you know this, Jung knew about the chakra system. In fact, he wrote about the Yoga Sutras and commented that he thought the chakra system should be adapted for the West. One of the chakras should be eliminated.
Which one?
I don't remember.
Whoops.
It's actually a book or a paper.
Well, maybe because Jung didn't have the benefit of different researches and translations that have happened since, although it's very still hasn't gotten that far much further, but a little bit. And that is that even in the Indian case, it's interesting that he would say that because in their own tradition, For some practices, you don't use all of the chakras, A and B. The chakras are not necessarily physiological structures that are sort of sitting here and there. They are ways in which they are software programs that the central nervous system can be programmed with. And then for certain types of practices, they don't program them with the full set. And or they have different sets. They have sometimes five, sometimes they only use three, sometimes they use seven or nine even, but very rarely. So the fact of like putting one chakra on ice, so to speak, is probably within fitting and probably in relation to his patients and his culture at that time, he was probably correct and even would have been approved by some of the adepts from ancient India, I would say, possibly. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but that's possible. Because, you know, people can't necessarily mobilize all those energies at once. It might be too much for people. And also, if any one individual opens up certain energies, it influences the society and the people around them, and it might create too much chaos and things. It's a very sophisticated. These esoteric traditions are very sophisticated. I mean, I don't know really how sophisticated they are personally, but I just know that they are.
Yes.
I thought it was really beautiful and fascinating, your association to the cultivated and the fallow fields. That in terms of the integration of black and white, and I wondered if you had anything to say to us about Tonglen practice.
About what? Tonglen?
Meditative practice, breathing in the evil, breathing out the good.
Yeah, sure. And you take the suffering of others into yourself as darkness in the form of smoke or clouds or waves of darkness. And then you turn them and you let the voidness in your heart, the awareness of voidness, the openness and transparency in your heart, absorb all that darkness, and then the pulsar of your love and compassion you send outward toward them. So you send your happiness out to them. Yeah, that's the Tonglen, in-breath and out-breath. That's how it's done. And the black and white in the center puts him in an integration of opposites balance to be able to do that. And seeing it in the countryside, though, I don't know if he's thinking constantly of that, or what made me think of that is, you know, the fact that they're living in a more sane way than we do today, where we think we have to grow all the time and we're destroying the planet. Mm-hmm. And when you had a more sane and healthy agriculture, you realize you have to leave certain parts non-producing at some time, which will then you rotate them and bring them in at another time. In other words, you don't just plant everything and pour chemicals on it and poison the entire world. Which we have done to ourselves in this country. We are just totally all poison. Our soil is poison. That's why we have cancer and all this, because we poisoned our soil, actually. Mm-hmm. And we are continuing to do so, and you don't hear a word about that in the health reform. Mm. Just some nonsense about insurance companies. Mm-hmm. Really? So there, that he has a countryside where there's some fallow and some planted is a kind of sign of a prosperity and a contentment, that they can afford to leave some fallow, and yet they feed everyone in that city.
To me, that's what I read it as, you know? But Donglen is great too, of course. That's what he's doing, I hope. That's what anybody who's happy does. They give their happiness away to others.